Welcome to the Tin Biscuit Podcast. Today we've got a new guest, and that is...
Jeffrey Munn, licensed marriage and family therapist.
Well, thanks for coming on, Jeff. We've been organising it for about 2 weeks now, is it? We've been trying to get it organised for?
Because
of the time zones and that, so like we finally nailed it. We first got to talking to each other because I made a comment on a tweet, and I believe the tweet was when there were... putting, was it Black Lives Matter in big yellow writing on a road? And I said to you, well, no, I didn't say to you, I like said, that's just virtual signaling. And you came back with a comment saying,
how do you distinguish between virtue signaling and trying to spread an important message?
Yeah.
I didn't mean it sarcastically. I think it's an important conversation to have because I think there is a difference.
Definitely. The reason why I ask people on my podcast when I'm like, they say something back, because it's like text is so ambiguous, you can't really make it out. And especially with things like Twitter, you're only limited. So I just say, come on my podcast and we can talk about it. And you're the only one who's took it up so far.
Okay, all right. Well, I'm glad I did.
So, no, going back to that original tweet, and then obviously we'll like... move on, because I've got some things that I like want to talk to you about. I think a lot of people are doing it for the right reason, but then again I think there's a lot of people doing it because they think they should do it, they think it's the right thing, and maybe they're being pressured. And there's also a big group of people, which I'm sure you're aware of, on Instagram, Facebook, I mean I'm not on Facebook, but like sort of like I've heard rumors of people doing it on Facebook, like putting black squares, and to me people are jumping on the bandwagon, and that's what I meant by a lot of it is virtual signaling, because it's not a true meaning behind the message. So do you get where I'm coming from? I think you should only do it if like you've got a precise, no, that's some like the wrong term. I think you should do it if you're really behind it, not just doing it because it makes you look cool or it's something you should be doing at that time.
Right. And I think it's hard to, you know, because I posted one of the black squares. I did it. And the reason I did it is because I have some, you know, black friends who follow me on Facebook. And I wanted them to know I'm behind you. You know, like I support you. I'm not someone who's, you know, against the Black Lives Matter movement or anything like that. But I'd be lying if there isn't a part of me that, you know, when I do that, I want people to be like, hey, good for you.
You know? No,
so I think there is kind of a combination. There can be a combo of the two.
Definitely.
But there certainly are people who I think do it just completely disingenuously, and it's like, look how great, you know, like Instagram influencers and people like that who will just use a photo op and do it just to look good, but really don't do anything else behind the scenes to actually contribute to the cause.
Yeah, because you saw a lot of the TikTok people, didn't you, like getting out when like the crowds were moving in with signs, and that was all pretty much within the same week. Going back to you said you've got a few friends that are black and that's why you put it up. Do you, like, you think that they should have already known you were supporting them without you putting the black square up?
Yes. I mean, they know I like them, but Yeah, obviously, because we're friends, but I want them to also know that the larger cause and the movement that's occurring, I support.
Yeah.
Now, how I support it is I support it in my own way, but I want them to know, like, hey, I'm on your side.
Yeah.
When it comes to this.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, I think it's possible for them to assume that I'm not, you know, that I might not be, even though I like them. Does that make sense? So, you know, I may be friends with them, but I mean, now most of them know me well enough to know that most likely I'm not going to be posting, you know, angry posts about Blue Lives Matter and stuff like that and going completely the other way.
Yeah.
So
do you think the Black Lives Movement has took a sway from what it originally was set to do, with like things like you've got Capitol Hill now turning into Chaz, and you've got, I believe you've got other states, parts of states that are like the policemen aren't going into, and there's autonomous zones being set up. Do you think the Black Lives Movement has moved from the original premise to more of a socialist takeover?
That's hard for me to say because you know, there's the movement is it's originally created by, you know, some people, and then some people take it somewhere else. And so I don't know that there's any one completely agreed upon central message. You know, I think there are some people with much more far left ideas that will use the cause as a way to, you know, further their agenda. Definitely. And then I think there are people who just stick to the strict message, the strict core of the message. So again, I think that's what's hard to tease apart is what is the real message? What aspects of this message are important to push and to spread, and which parts maybe are, you know, leaving the realm of what's rational and practical. And so, you know, and I think that's hard to do. And I think what's important is that we have a conversation about it.
Definitely.
I think it's important that we be able to talk about it. And right now, the unfortunate climate is that we can't talk about it. It's you either completely 100% agree with everything that's being said in the name of the Black Lives Matter movement and things like that, or you are a completely, you're a bigoted racist and you have no.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, what if we just want to have a conversation about what is the real message and how do we do this and what's the best way to do it? And especially because I'm a white man too, I don't have a place to say, okay, but let's look at this more. You know, I either say I'm completely for you and agree with you 100%, or I shut my mouth. Those are kind of my only options. And to a certain extent, I understand. I can understand why black people right now are furious. You know, I get that as much as I can, being someone who hasn't experienced it myself. But I still think it's always important to be able to have conversations about the nuances of a specific situation.
Yeah, because I did go on the Black Lives Matter website, and like at the top of the page, it's got a hashtag of defund the police. What's some of your views on defund the police? Because, like, obviously, it's not working out well for Chaz, I don't think, at the minute, and like sort of other zones that are being set up. I mean, Twitter's reporting things where people are being extortioned for money, people like white people getting beat up, or so there's threats to blacks and whites. What's some like your view on the hashtag defund the police?
I think there are aspects of the movement that make sense. I think. Here's an exact example of what I'm talking about. So I think the hashtag defund the police is counterproductive because it's so extreme. Right? When you hear defund, you hear defund. That's the word they're using, is take funds, all funds away from the
police. That's the exact message that I'm like getting, and I'm sure it's the exact message everyone else is getting.
Exactly. And so, you know, if I try to bring up a point that, like, you know, there's absolutely a case to be made for police reform. You know, we have so much evidence now with, you know, people being able to record on their cell phones. There's so much evidence of police just completely screwing up their jobs. Right. And I want to also say, I'm sure it's a difficult job. I'm not a cop. I've never been trained. I'm sure, you know, I want to have compassion for what they do too. But we have plenty of evidence to show that there's a desperate need for more training and a better police system. And so I absolutely agree with that it needs to be reformed. The idea of defunding the police, some people will say when they say that they mean actually abolish the police. And some people will say, well, no, it's just something we're saying that really means reform the police. And those are two very different things, you know. And
they could just use reform instead of defund, because like that's an instant hashtag message that puts out, like, it's like sort of, it's like a bit aggressive. Defund the police. We want to rule ourselves.
I just think it's too absolute. And so people who are on the fence, people who, you know, don't understand that when you're saying defund the police, you don't literally mean abolish the police, although some people do. But people are not going to want to hear that nuance. They're not going to be open to hearing the finer details of the movement if it's presented in such a polarized way. People who are on the fence or people who are more right-leaning are going to immediately, I think, shut down. And we've seen it. We've seen it on, you know, some of the more right-wing news outlets, Sean Hannity, things like that. They go straight to look at the you know, the crazy left wanting to completely get rid of the police.
Yeah.
Because they hear that part of it, and that's what they run with. And don't bother to hear sort of the more nuanced aspects of the movement. So I think it's important that it be presented in a way that is more digestible to people who may not fully understand it. Now, and then, but I have, it's not entirely my place to say that also, because then I am a white man who's, you know, quote unquote, criticizing a movement created by people of color and people who have been, you know, mistreated by the police. So it's just, it's a very delicate situation. It's hard to know how to navigate it.
And that's going back to 2018 when I first started my podcast. This is one of the reasons why I started my podcast, purely because I can have everyone on from the right to the left to central. Anyone's welcome on the podcast. And you know, I've like had people on the right and I've had people on the left on, because I think conversation is what's needed to make people realize and think. Going back to the Black Lives Matter issue, what do you feel about taking the knee? Because football or soccer, as like we call it, in you guys call it soccer, we might call it football,
right?
Like sort of all the Premiership football teams have had Black Lives Matter, they've had the names taken off the back of the shirts, they've had Black Lives Matter on, and I do believe everyone took the knee at the game last night because the Premiership started up, and even the referees done. Now my question is like that sincere kneeling, or is that just for the media and to show our football clubs doing it?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I can't presume to know the motivation behind them doing that. I think there is, I think most likely it's sincere. I don't have a problem with it. I think it's free speech. If there's something that they have a problem with and want to protest again and want to use their platform to spread that message, I'm okay with that. And I think,
yeah,
I think we should listen. So I don't have any issue with it personally.
No, I mean, if like you want to kneel, you like kneel because it's freedom of choice, freedom of expression. The like only thing I was wary about is if like a member of a football team said, well, I don't feel comfortable with kneeling, but he was pressurized into doing so.
Sure, sure. Yeah, that's, I don't believe that's okay, you know, but that's a tough situation. I mean, if you're saying if they're doing it because they were pressured into it?
Yeah, sort of like they felt like they had to do it, because another example of that is 2 weeks ago, some of the UK police actually took the knee in sort of front of Black Lives Matter's protesters, and I think that shocked a lot of the UK because they thought, well, the police shouldn't be showing political allegiances, and if something does kick off and there is rioting, which there has been rioting, how's the police going to react? Are they going to be in favor of BLM because like they've took the knee, or are they going to be neutral? But if they're taking the knee, it's not a neutral position, especially if you're in the police. So that's why I asked them two questions that were linked.
Right. Unfortunately, it's been so polarized, though, that there is no neutral position right now. And people have been pushed to one end or the other.
And that link,
it's either you're taking a knee or you are completely against, you know, us and our movement. And I don't think anything really is that black and white, poor choice of words. I don't think anything is that polarized, that all or nothing.
Yeah, it's because it's, I feel it's making a bigger divide now, and I sort of think it's set race relations back quite a few years with everything what's going on. Do you think it's sort of set a divide up, like sort of even more than if like there was a divide?
I don't know. I think it's done a little bit of both. I've seen people come together more. Mm-hmm. I've seen more white people understand what it's like to be a person of color, or at least listen to people of color talk about their experience in the world in America. So I think it's done a little bit of both. And then I think people who are already on the extreme end of either spectrum have probably been pushed further towards their extreme ends. Yeah, but I do think it's created some more unity as well, from my point of view, which is...
Yeah. Limited. Well, no, it's going to bring people together, a bit like COVID-19 brought people together, but it's also separating people, as I'm like, well, and it's not COVID-19, BLM.
Yeah, I think it is in some ways, sure. I think it's, tempers are hot right now, and this is a very hot topic, and it's understandable. But everybody spreads their message and approaches it in a different way, and some people, I think, are doing that in... And this is not a race thing, not black or white. I think just people who are behind any movement have a tendency to either promote that movement in a way that is rational and straightforward and digestible for other people, or in a way that's very extreme and pushes people away. And yeah. I think both of those things are happening, depending on who's, doing the message spreading.
Well, it's the media doing the message, like, spreading.
They're a huge part, yeah. Yeah, they have conflicting interests. They want views. They want to be seen. They want to make noise. And it's hard to reconcile that motivation with actually genuinely, spreading a message. Because
on one side you've got Fox, and on the other you've got CNN, and they're giving two different outlooks to what's going on, which is you get that on Twitter. Hence, going back to the podcast, why I set this up in the first place, 2018, I want to try and be in the middle and have people on from both sides, regardless of anything, to say what they think. And because, again, that's the only way things are going to get sorted out, is through proper discussion, not through guns, not through violence, not through peaceful protesting. Yeah, because the thing with peaceful protesting is it makes people aware of issues. Absolutely. And also makes people aware that people do actually care. But then you will get the people like TikTokers, the influencers, the people who think I should be doing that, and they don't know the real connotations behind what they're doing. Hence why I said on that tweet, it's all virtual signaling.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's how we met. And going on, it transcribes that you're an author.
Yeah, I wrote a book. Wrote a couple books. The one that's the most popular right now is the "Staying Sober Without God,"
and that's the one that I've ordered off Amazon. It's yet to turn up. No, that's fine. So, do you want to tell us a bit more about that and how the old book writing thing came about?
Yeah, so I am a recovering addict alcoholic myself. I have 14 years of sobriety, and I'm also an atheist. I don't believe in a supreme being or a god.
Is there anything that stopped you from believing in that, or like, was there an event in your life that thought, well, I don't believe in God, or was it something you've had for all your life?
It's a good question. I've never been very religious or I've never had a very strong belief in God. I did believe in God kind of when I was younger, because everyone else seemed to believe in it, and so I just was like, okay, God. It wasn't really pushed on me growing up. My dad was very mildly religious, and my mom was, for all intents and purposes, an atheist as well, but neither one of them pushed their belief system on me, so I kind of figured it out on my own. And I just never saw, to me, what was compelling evidence of a Judeo-Christian style God.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't believe. Now, that doesn't mean I am absolutely 100% sure there is no God, because I think people sometimes confuse, you know, I'm what Richard Dawkins would refer to as a de facto atheist. You know, a 6 on a scale of 1 to 7. You know, seven would be I absolutely know there's no God. I can't say that because it, to me it seems, how do you prove a negative? But yeah, everything that I've seen leads me to believe that there most likely is not. And so if you look at the 12-step model, it's very reliant on God. The word God is in, I believe, 6 out of 12 of the 12 steps. And I got sober without really ever buying into a belief in God. Now, I also got into the field of psychotherapy and realized that a lot of what was happening in the 12 steps when people were doing these, when people were taking these 12 steps and experiencing changes in their lives, a lot of what was happening made sense on a psychological level, mm-hmm. right? You know, that people would refer to it as a miracle, you know, oh, it's a miracle that this person is, you know, gone from being an alcoholic to being sober. And my response to that, at least internally, was always, why is that a miracle? If something might have happened psychologically, and maybe it's really important that we look at what happened. Like, how did this person change to the point where they can now not use drugs and alcohol to cope with daily life? And so I became more interested in just developing my own interpretation of what was going on when people were referring to these spiritual experiences and things like that. And so I wrote a book that's basically a version of the 12 steps that does not include any belief in a supreme being.
Right? Isn't like that the main reason you thought you'd do a book, you'd put a different slant on it, taken away from God and putting it through the atheist's view?
Yeah, and also, I don't even like to say that I put that it's from an atheist perspective. It's just not from a religious perspective. It's from a psychological perspective.
Do you think that helps more? Because people who don't believe in God, if they went to the 12-step program that's got God in it, if people didn't believe, do you think they'd be inclined not to do the 12-step?
They are. Maybe not everybody, but I've absolutely seen people who, for that reason alone, they show up to a 12-step meeting and they see God and hear God all over the place.
And then they've gone.
And they leave and they're gone. Yeah, and I've seen it a lot. And that was one of the primary reasons too. And there are other programs that don't take a religious approach. There are things like Smart Recovery. And those programs are fine. I haven't had personal experience with them, being in them or running them or anything like that. But they're so small compared to AA. You know, AA and the 12-step programs are huge. And there's so many people and there's meetings everywhere. And that's a real benefit it has, is that it's so available. And so I thought, rather than just pushing people to go to a different program if they didn't like the God approach, was go to AA, but work it in a way that makes sense to you. Do it in a way that makes sense to you.
Yeah.
Because it's the most available still.
So tell us a bit more about your 12-step program and how you came to formulate it up. Was it something you had help with, or was it something you just thought of? And because obviously you've been through it, you've got a lot of background. I mean, 14 years, excellent for doing that, by the way, well, like, done. How long did it take to write the book and things like that?
The book is a product of me translating the program in my own head for many, many years, and then also helping people who struggled with addiction in my own practice as a therapist. And so it was all stuff that I had kind of had in my head already, and I just decided to start putting it down. And it didn't take me too long to write the book once I decided to actually sit down and write it. It took about 2 months to put it all together. And it was it's just stuff that I had floating around in my head, and I thought, like, I feel like I have a pretty good understanding of how the program has worked for me. And if you read the book, you'll see there's nowhere in there that I'm saying this is how you have to do it. this is the right way to do it. This was my interpretation of it. This worked for me. I wanted to give people who didn't like the religious approach an option. Mm-hmm. I don't say it's the only non-religious option. I'm very careful about telling people the right way to do anything. But yes. here is what I did. Here's my interpretation of what happened for me psychologically. And here's how I believe you can achieve the same results.
I mean, 14 years is a hell of a long time. I mean, like, you must be proud of yourself. Immensely proud of yourself.
I mean, I try to shy away from pride because, you know, there were a lot of things in my life that I was lucky to have access to. I was lucky to have access to therapy. The 12-step program itself, I don't think got me sober. I needed more therapy. I needed some, group therapy, things like that are expensive that not everybody can afford. I was lucky to have resources in my family. So I'm happy that I'm sober this long. I'm grateful that I had the means to stay sober this long. I believe that there are a lot of people who if they had the resources I had, would be able to get sober, but aren't able to because they don't. So in a lot of ways, I know I'm lucky.
Was it just alcohol you was doing like 14 years ago? Was there any other substances, anything else?
It was everything, really. I mean, it was, I smoked marijuana all day, every day. And then it would be, alcohol, some of the harder drugs, methamphetamine, things like that. It was just whatever was available. Lots of opiates, things like that.
Right. And like, so again, 14 years is a vast amount of time. And like, again, well, like done. Have you ever been tempted or been tempted to have a sip of alcohol or like have some like marijuana or another prescribed medicine or like meth again or anything like that?
Well, one of the things that most of the recovery community agrees on is that, if a doctor prescribes you medication, talk it over with your mentor, also known as a sponsor in the 12-step program. Talk it over with them and decide, how you're going to do that. And I was prescribed pain medication after a surgery, and I took one, and I loved it. And I immediately told my wife, I'm like, we got to throw this away. We can't. And so, it's still there. The beast is still in there. And when things are really, at social gatherings, when everyone's all loosey-goosey and drinking, sure, it's would be nice to be able to sit with them and have a glass of wine. The thing is, I don't do that. I've proven to myself time and time again that I will take a sip of wine. And then it just starts this obsession about like, oh, can I have another? And, oh, I can drink now. So when am I going to have my next glass of wine? And, maybe I should, whatever. I'll come up with any excuse to start again. It's just what I do. It's how my brain works. I love the feeling of being under the influence so much so that it takes over.
Yeah, I think sort of that's the danger on like how easy it is accessible with drink, marijuana, and like other drugs, where it just takes a short amount of time and then you're in an altered state. But then when you come back from that altered state, you still got the same problems, but you've got an added problem with addiction, or should we say reliance and habitual routines, because that's going to incorporate that, and that will have a knock-on effect with obviously your everyday life, your family life, your working life, and it's sort of disastrous.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. It just adds on more consequences and more stress.
So you say you've written another book that's apart from your 12 step.
Yeah, I wrote a couple others. One was for parents of children who are addicted to video games.
Oh, right. Tell us more about that. Because you are a qualified therapist, then you say.
Yeah, I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist in California, and so this was another one I felt like I had a unique view on, so I wanted to write a book because I am myself an addict, and video games were a huge part of my addiction, and I want to differentiate between addiction and compulsion too. Addiction is more a chemical that's actually influencing your brain chemistry directly and creates a physical dependence. And, so I'm not saying that video games necessarily do that. And there's research to show that there's differences between addictions and compulsions, but that's, you know, that's neither here or there.
No, that's interesting because I thought addiction is your body relying on it to like function with it. And that's one of the things about being an alcoholic. So if you're an alcoholic, it's because you need that to function.
Yeah, and the truth is, with drugs and alcohol, that's a part of it, but that's not the whole story. Because you can be physically dependent on something, and if you're not very psychologically dependent on it, if it's not something that you really enjoy, it's not that difficult for people to wean off of it and just be like, oh, okay, I'm done with that. Like, they may feel a physical craving for a little bit, but it's not huge. And then once they've gotten through the physical craving, they don't think about it again.
Right.
So the physical dependence is a part of it, but it's not the whole story.
Okay. So going back to the video games, because that will tie into something I was going to mention to you about how addictive technology is and how technology is incorporating into our everyday life. And it's like we're reliant on technology now. If like you've got a small business and you're not up to date with, say, like a PayPal card machine where it's contactless payment, you might be lagging behind. So therefore, if you didn't want that bit of technology in your business, it's like you have to have it or your business will fail. And this is the rate of technology is going fast, and it's going fast, the rate of technology, and I'm the worst of being addicted on my phone, even to just see. And like, psychologically, I know I'm just doing this, and sometimes I'm not even on a screen, I'm just seeing what pops up,
right?
Mm-hmm. So
yeah, there's a little dopamine hit, you know. I don't know if you're familiar with the chemical dopamine, but
do you want to tell us a bit more about it, just for the listeners and viewers?
So this is, you know, it's an oversimplification, and there's a lot more involved that I'm not a neuroscientist, but on a very fundamental level, there is a chemical in our brain called dopamine, and that chemical is responsible partially for making us want to do something again. It's the reward chemical. So, you know, if you have sex, it releases a lot of dopamine, and that makes sense on an evolutionary level, because our brains are wired to motivate us to procreate. So, you know, when sex, for example, feels really good. Eating feels really good because it leads to our survival. And so our brains say, oh, that was good. Do that again. Keep doing that, right? Because it serves a purpose. The problem is we've kind of hijacked that part of our brain with, you know, other rewarding things in our world, like technology, you know. So social interaction is rewarding, right? When you get together with friends and you have a good time, every interaction that's positive releases a little bit of dopamine. And, you know, it's like it motivates you to be social. We get that tapped into every time we open up Facebook or Twitter or whatever, and there's a little red notification icon right by the message.
Get all excited.
Right. It's like, ooh, I've connected with somebody.
Yeah.
Ooh, valid. Something I wrote got attention. People are paying attention, and it feels good, and it releases that dopamine. But that's a much easier way to get that dopamine release than it is to call up a friend and go hang out and do, you know, it's so we found these sort of cheap ways to release dopamine, these cheap and easy ways to release dopamine in our brain. And we will naturally choose whatever is the easiest way to get that hit. And so many people just lean more towards, you know, staying on social media and doing that to get that hit rather than actually going out and interacting socially. And there's a million different examples of that.
Do you think that's dangerous in a way where it's taking the person out of human contact? And especially with the COVID-19, lockdowns where people just stuck at home, obviously people were more reliant on their technology to communicate like that, but we do need that human interaction, don't we? We do need that human touch and that human conversation, because if we have it again talking over the podcast compared to arguing or talking over Twitter, do you know what I mean? It's a bit more, you can express yourself more when, like, human contact and like this. I mean, I know we're doing it over technology because I'm in the UK and you're in the USA, but we've still got some sort of human contact because I can see you, you can see me, we can hear each other. But with technology on the phone and doing all this, it's not really... I just think humanity is going to lose its way and technology might be a big part of our downfall.
I think it's very possible. It's a double-edged sword. Technology is fantastic in that there are times where we would be sitting at home doing nothing, but now we can interact with people.
Yeah.
So it's both increased and decreased our human interaction. We are talking more than ever. And less than ever.
Yeah,
it's this weird combo. And so I think what's important is to provide education and teach people about the power of social media and, you know, the psychological effects of it and how important it is to keep things in balance. I think we need to be educated and I think we need to use it wisely.
I find it hard. I do like reading and I like love watching films, but 3 pages into a book, I've got to check my phone. 10 yeah. minutes into a film, I've just got to check my phone and I'm listening and I'm doing things and I think I'm doing it, but then I miss part of the film. And I just think maybe 10, 15 years ago, we wouldn't have had that distraction.
Mm-hmm.
We still had this technology, but we didn't have the big enough distraction than it is now, especially now with what's going on with COVID, BLM, and I don't know, things in China happening. It's all taken us away from what we should be doing is relaxing. And while we're not relaxing, we're getting more anxious through technology.
Yeah, I think it's being over-connected. Mm. Being hyper-connected is a problem. And I think also people who are very, very connected, there is this... So, like, my parents are going to watch this, but I'm going to talk crap about my parents right now. So my parents watch news all day.
Yeah.
They take small breaks to eat, but they watch news all day. And when I ask them, do you always have the news blast? I mean, they're sitting in their recliners, they're retired, sitting in their recliners watching news all day. And I think to myself, what are you doing? And their response is usually, we're being informed. We're staying informed. And the truth is, we have this illusion that we're connected and we know what's going on if we're constantly checking social media and the news and things, like we're plugged in so we know what's going on.
Mm.
And we're not. We're plugged into a very small version of what's going on, and it's actually a distortion of what's really going on in the world, right? So if you spend all day watching the same news cycle, watching the same violent crime happen over and over again, it creates this sense in your mind that it's this huge thing that's happening everywhere all the time. It's actually presenting a distorted reality. And so it's really important that we unplug on occasion, because being too plugged in actually is not giving us a very clear idea of what's actually going on out there in the world, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's like hard work and it's draining to like carry on. I mean, with the podcast, I've took more attention to the news and I've had more than one news site on like my phone, so I can sort of get the in between lines, one, you know, like Sky News, BBC, ITV News, The Sun, The Daily Mirror, just bits and bobs like that, just so I can gauge what they're all saying. They're pretty much saying they're all same thing but paraphrasing it, and they all put their own slant on it. Mm-hmm. And going back, it's just draining. It's just draining having all this information blasted at you. And it's like, well, everywhere you turn, it's like, I can't even look on my phone to just see what my friend in Leeds in like the UK, Manchester, or in like Australia is doing, because someone's posting like a violent image of a black or a white person getting battered, or a policeman shooting someone, or someone shooting the police. And I think that's got a danger psychologically towards you as well. It's not just the technology, it's what's coming from technology. What's some sort of your tips of people unplugging and taking a step back and thinking? Because even if you wanted to put your phone down, people couldn't get in contact with you. So it's counterproductive. What's some like your tips if I'm like someone wanted to take a step out and think, I'm going to have a week where I just want to recharge myself and come back to it?
A week's a long time. You said that, and I immediately was like, oh, a week.
I know. I am thought a week. A day, then.
Yeah. Well, it has to be structured. It doesn't have to be structured. It helps if it's structured, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, at the end of the day or at this time of the evening. Remember back in the day when we had just landline phones, no cell phones? There would just be a time where people stopped contacting you. It was usually like you agreed upon that around 9 or 10
you get the phone call.
You just don't call people, right? You just don't. Yeah. But now it's like all the time. And so setting some of your own boundaries around, you know, at 9 o'clock or at 8 o'clock or whatever, phone is off. You know, the phone is off, or the phone's in another room.
But the hard part, switching the phone off or not going to the other room to see if you've got a message from social media.
It takes practice. It's hard. And I'm big on the practice of mindfulness meditation. Not just mindfulness meditation, but mindfulness in and of itself, which can be done through formal sitting meditation or not.
Yes.
But in moments like that, it's really important to just sort of get quiet and see what's going on in your mind. Like when you feel that urge to go check the phone, it's really important to just kind of sit with it. It's not going to kill you. You know, it may feel like it. It may feel like your head's going to explode if you don't check the phone, but it's not going to kill you. And so to practice sitting with it and just experiencing what it's like and seeing like what's behind this crazy drive to go check the phone. Oh, I'm worried I'm missing out. I'm afraid. I'm, you know, making up in my head that someone desperately needs to reach me and I'm not available or something like that. And learning how to sit with and tolerate that craving, which is the same thing, is something called urge surfing that we talk to addicts about, which is you're surfing the urge. You know, the urge comes like a wave and you just observe it and sit with it and do your best to just ride it and let it run its course without letting it dictate your behavior.
I mean, like, is there any tips on doing that? Because like some people might say, well, instead of that, I'll just open a bottle of wine. And again, you might be in a precarious situation where you was 14 years ago. And right. Again, that's counterproductive. One thing I do find helps, since lockdown began in the UK, I've come off my medication for anxiety and like sort of depression, which is sort of through that hard time and me being sort of cooped up, I just thought I'm just going to come off them. But one thing I do is called box breathing, where you inhale for 4 seconds, hold it for 4 seconds, mm-hmm. exhale right. for 4 seconds. So that's a bit of a meditation. Then it releases your tension in your body. But sometimes I say I'll do that after I've checked my phone, and then I check my phone, then I lead on to something else.
Yeah, well, hey, but you're still doing it.
Well, that's like, you know, like sort of, yeah. You was going on about video games and the addiction to video games. Do you, like, you think there is a problem with video games? Because I've like read reports where it can actually boost people's IQ because it's hand-eye coordination, and it's also solving right. problems. And on the other hand, you can smash your TV up if you love your control through it.
Yeah, and you're gonna realize this as you talk to me, that there's everything is nuanced, everything is you know, on a spectrum, and everything's gray. There's a lot of gray area.
Yeah.
People want answers that are absolute. You know,
people want a yes and a no.
Video games are addictive or video games are not addictive. That doesn't work that way. People have the capacity to become addicted to video games, is how I like to say it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rewarding behavior, and if we find it particularly rewarding, there is a chance that we can become compulsive around it to the point where it seems difficult to stop on our own. And that's all I mean when I say a video game addiction. So it's like with the phone, right? You're not injecting the phone into your bloodstream. There's no actual outside chemical being introduced into your body, but there's this psychological cycle that you're in, and there's and like you said, it's hard to stop on your own. And so that's what I refer to as a compulsion. or as a, you know, a video game addiction would be like you're talking about with your cell phone, but with video games. Like, oh, I just want to play so badly. I just want to like zone out and play. But it's to the point where you can't stop even though you've tried or you want to. That's when I think it crosses the line into what I'll call an addiction or a compulsion.
Do you think it matters on the person's state of mind as well? Doesn't like sort of some people just naturally Absolutely. Have that addiction Absolutely. In them?
Yes, and there are some people that just don't become addicted to things.
Would you say people who become more addicted to things might have a slight autism about them? Like they might be a bit more autistic? Because like when I was younger, I used to focus all my time. I mean, if I have one interest still, if I have an interest, I've got to focus all my thing on one interest. I can't have another interest. If another interest comes, that main interest will get pushed and I'll bring that other interest in. Sure. And I still can't figure out how to do two. So like my main one at the minute is podcasting. So but I cheat and I can interact that because I can find out things. I can read books and gain information to do my other podcasting. But I can never go into an interest fully and still have my podcasting. So do you think, and I know, I think I'm a bit on like the autistic scale. But do you think people who are more highly addictive are more autistic than people who aren't highly addictive?
Well, I want to just differentiate between autism and any other type of mental difference.
As I say, don't listen to me. I'm the last person anyone should be listening to.
That results in some sort of different kind of behavior. You know, I mean, people will label it ADHD also. That's a very, what you're talking about is very typical of ADHD, where when you're focused, you're hyper-focused. But it's like one thing intent. I'm the same way. I'm just, when I get into one thing, I get into one thing. When I was writing my books, I was writing my books. You know, it was what I was doing. And so I definitely think there are qualities that people who become addicted to things share. I think there's commonalities between them, but I don't think there's any one thing. I wouldn't say, you know, oh, if you become addicted to video games, you're on the autism spectrum or you must have ADHD. There's a lot of different things. And a lot of times things like childhood trauma, just poor emotional regulation. So people who are not good at when they feel angry, sad, frustrated, who are not good at dealing with that on their own, will often turn to outside things to regulate how they're feeling. And that can look like an addiction and become a compulsion as well.
Yeah, I can definitely see what you mean about polarization and being yes and no and just a straight answer. There's more parts to it than that. Okay, then. So, if people wanted to find out more about your book and you and how to get your books, what's the best course of action for you? Because obviously I don't want you to say everything on the podcast because people just listen to the podcast and not buy your books.
Well, you can find me on just Amazon. You can search Jeffrey Munn on Amazon.com and my books will pop up. And you can find me on practicallysane.net.
Right. practicallysane.net.
There I do some blogging and I have some information about how to get a hold of me directly and things like that.
That's brilliant. I will put all that in the description.
Excellent. Thank
you. Again, thank you for coming onto the podcast. I've got plenty to talk to you about, but obviously I'm going to find out all like sort of through your books. Is there any plans to write further books for yourself or for like other people?
Yeah, I'm currently working on a workbook for the 12-step book. So it would be a larger book that they actually people can actually do the writing inside of it, and it has prompts and things like that. So I felt like that was maybe a good accompaniment.
That was also So if someone struggled on their own doing the 12-step book, is there any suggestions within the book or that you can give if like someone lived on their own and they didn't have anyone to speak with and like they had your book but like was finding it hard to get through that book, is there any advice you like sort of could give them?
Yeah, I always suggest that you do it with somebody else. And preferably somebody else in the program. Now, you can try and find somebody in the program who does not take a very religious approach, and they're around. But I think it's really important to have somebody to kind of guide you through it, even with the book. I think it's important because some of the steps involve talking things through with another person. So I think it's important to do that. Can people do it on their own? Possibly. I didn't. But I think it's important to find somebody, and it's easier now. Talk about, you know, technology. It's easier now more than ever, you know, that we have online meetings and forums, and so you can find somebody online.
Yeah, I mean, technology does serve its purpose. If, I mean, again, the good thing about technology is through these like riots, these protests, and this COVID shutdown, if someone didn't want to leave, they can obviously get on their phone, they can go onto the internet, and like they can reach out to people. So mm-hmm. technology does play its part, but I think technology will be a bit more harmful in the future than we realize, which is ironic because I'm doing technology with my podcast. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I'm just reliant on technology to get the message out, because obviously before you were, Mike was saying about you had to put, you know, 20p in a phone machine or go mm-hmm. to a phone box, and then you had to have a set time to ring. And with dial-up, you couldn't use your phone if you was on the internet. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I like sort of think it's a double-edged sword, and it's a very interesting one.
Agreed.
So, well, thanks again for coming on. I like...
Yeah, thanks for having me.
No, cheers for that. Yeah, brilliant stuff. Okay, I'll put everything in the description, and I'll see you soon.
All right.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. Bye. The Tea Biscuits Podcast.